Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Having a goddamn blast on tour with this Big Mouth and a Small Town tour, so I've added some dates and wanted to let you know where I'm headed next. March 14th, I will be in Lakeside, Arizona, and then the 15th and 16th, I'm finally coming to Tucson. So if you're in Tucson, I'm coming to Laughs Comedy Cafe. Get your tickets. We're going to have a good time. My good friend Noah Kopfer will be featuring at those shows. He'll also be with me the following weekend when I come to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Dr. Grins, I cannot wait to see you guys again. Those are always some of my favorite shows, and I'm sure this year will be no exception. And then I am headed up to my home state of Alaska for the Alaska Before You Die Fest. Anchorage, you better not fucking sit on these tickets. They're going fast. There's a few left. April 5th, I will be doing shows at the Gumbo House. It's downtown. I'm doing an early and a late show, one night only. It's an intimate venue, so tickets are limited. It's going to be out of control. If you've come to my show at Coots before, you know how fun they are. This venue is so much better for comedy. I can't even explain it. Just get fucking tickets. These shows are going to be wild. And then on the 6th, I'm headed down to Homer, Alaska. I am coming, performing there for the first time. Alice's Champagne Palace. And then on the 7th, I will be in Seward, Alaska. So Anchorage, Homer, Seward, we're having a goddamn good time. I'm going to come kill it all those shows because I'm a fucking Alaskan assassin. Am I sorry I said that? I don't know. Listen, Dayton, Kentucky, 12th of April. If you are in the Cincinnati-ish area, Dayton, Ohio, Dayton, Kentucky, this is your chance to see me at a really cool new venue called the Commonwealth Sanctuary. And then I am headed to Portland, May 3rd. I'm headlining the Rip City Comedy Festival. I will be at McMenamin's Mission Theater. You guys, this is a cool theater. We want it to be packed out because I want it to be packed out. But also, like, let's have a goddamn good time in this nice, beautiful theater. So come to that. It's going to be a hell of a time. I can't wait to come back to Portland. And then Wisconsin, I'm headed back your way. But this time I'm coming to Janesville, May 17th and 18th, Green Bay on the 19th. And then what up, Florida, St. Pete, Tampa, I'm coming your way. Tampa, I will be there June 2nd, and St. Pete, they're ahead of that, May 31st. Tampa, I'm at Side Splitters, and if you go to the links in all of my bios or go to their website to get tickets, for a limited time, you can use the code JMS and get $5 off tickets. And wherever you are, I'm trying to get people to buy tickets early instead of waiting to the last minute and making me panic, so that if it is going to sell out, it sells out faster, so that I know that, the club knows that, maybe we can add a second show. It just FYI, that helps every artist that you're a fan of. So if you can ever buy ASAP, go ahead and do that. So that's your incentive to buy early in Tampa. And I'll be adding more dates soon. If you did not hear your town but you want me to come there, head over to my Instagram, instagram.com/JMS Comedy, or just at JMS Comedy if you're using the app like most of us. Click the link in my bio, join my email list. That lets me know where you guys are so I know what areas want to come see me. So do that. I can't wait to get to more cities. I'm having so much fucking fun on the road. You guys have been amazing. People have been buying merch. These audiences have been out of control good, just electric, laughing, having a blast. And I know all these upcoming shows are going to be no exception. So I will see you there. JMScomedy.com/shows to get your tickets. Tell your friends. Tell your enemies. We're going to have a fucking good time either way. So thanks for listening to this little promo. Enjoy this episode. Ta-ta, idiots.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard.
What kind of ignorant shit is that?
At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought.
You idiot, you fool!
Hey, dummy!
This is the Ignorance is Blessed podcast.
Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
Hey, idiots, welcome back to Ignorance is Blessed, the podcast that attempts to overcome ignorance, mostly by asking ignorant questions. I'm your host, JMS. I'm a comedian, and I'm ignorant, and that's why we're here. You get to hear my sometimes poignant, but usually dumb questions about whatever the given topic is. If you are new to the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. It really helps me, helps other people find it, and then we can all learn the answers to our ignorant questions. Thank you so much to all the new subscribers and reviewers. Thank you to everyone who has left a rating and a review. I really appreciate that. Seriously, it helps. So if you have an iPhone, open that purple podcast app, go to browse, or go to search for Ignorance is hashtag blessed, scroll down to where it says write a review, and have at it. I would greatly appreciate it. And I'll screenshot your review and throw it out there to the social media world as it comes out live. And thank you for that. Shout out to my best idiots forever, Gene and Kathy. Those are top tier patrons. If you want to get involved in my Patreon so you can hear bonus content, such as right now I'm reading Harry Potter chapter by chapter. And also every episode over an hour is only available through the Patreon. So you get to hear the first free hour, which is full of content. It's a great interview, but in the event that an episode goes longer than an hour, which they often do, this one went 2 hours, you gotta head over to the Patreon, and for as little as $1 a month, you can get bonus content, fun interactions, postcards, and more. Patreon.com/ignoranceisblessed, and that'll help me out. I do this podcast otherwise for free, with the exception of that. So please head over, give me $1, get the rest of this cool interview because it is an awesome one. Also, if you're trying to get things done in the quarantine or you're just wanting a little energy and focus, NeuroGum is the official sponsor of this podcast as of now because they found me through my loud love of NeuroGum. So this is an authentic review, and they just happened to hook me up with a code for you guys if you're interested. It's got L-theanine and B vitamins and caffeine. So when you chew the gum, you get energized, but because of the L-theanine, which is a naturally occurring nootropic in your brain, and the B vitamins, it's a focused energy. So you're not just shaky and rattly and bouncing off the walls. You can zone in on whatever you're doing. And it has been a lifesaver for me. It helps me feel focused, which in turn helps my depression and anxiety because I am happier when I'm getting things done and focused. Also, you can join the Facebook group to get involved in discussions, and that doesn't cost a penny. Facebook.com/groups/ignoranceisblessed. Just look up ignorance's hashtag blessed idiots and you should find it. And you can jump in, ask ignorant questions, start a discussion, share memes, do whatever. We're having fun over there. We'd love to have you. And no shows coming up for the rest of eternity, probably. Besides online ones, I will be doing Comedy Quarantine this Friday between 7 and 8 p.m. That is a quarantined show. You can follow the Instagram at Comedy Quarantine, and I'll be on there. And then Thursday, I'm doing a show that is shot from Zurich, so it is 11 a.m. Pacific time, but evening time over there if you are in the Europe area or you just want a daytime show. That's the online comedy show. Just look at my Instagram profile, JMS Comedy. Keep an eye out. I'll be posting about it in my stories. And let's get to the episode. Franco is my guest. Franco Maruffo, he's a rad dude, and he talks to me about being diagnosed with and working on his mental health as a result and overcoming the struggle of dissociative identity disorder, which, if you're unfamiliar with that term, it's the fancy way of saying split personalities. So it's a real life split personality. I know I've had one years ago, if you've listened to the early episodes, with Dez, and now I have a whole new case, a different situation. Cool guy from Scotland who just kept it real. We had a lot of discussions. It was one long discussion, but we had a lot of talk about his DID, how he's dealing with it, what the treatment looks like, and some other some other fun stuff, like mushrooms, of course. Will I ever start editing out my stutters and coughs? Maybe not. That's neither here nor there. Enjoy Franco Marufo.
Hey, idiots. I am here on Skype with my friend Franco. Thank you for joining us, Franco.
Hey.
And we're going to talk about something. Where do we start? It's very interesting. I feel like a lot of people have only heard about this from, feel free to correct me if you think that's not true, but like, they have like the movie media version of what we're going to talk about, which is dissociative identity disorder.
Right, sure. It's typically just referred to as split personality in movies. And in the past, it was referred to as split personality, but strangely enough, it's not accurately represented in that kind of media format.
I'm shocked. The media is misrepresenting something.
I know. Crazy. I know.
Yeah, well, because a lot of times it's depicted as, I'm trying to think of the movies I know of. Split, obviously, was one of the more recent ones, but kind of people make it scary or maybe a little more cartoonish. I don't know if that's the right word. Then
I think like the main thing that the movies kind of they kind of go too far with is that they present it in such a way that it's when other people look at it, they're like, that is a very, very alien thing to me, you know. But in reality, when you break this dissociative identity disorder down, it's actually some of it, or most of it really, is quite familiar to most people. And the only difference with a kind of like a regular person and someone with a disorder is it's just a bit more extreme with the disorder, you know?
Yeah. I guess we'll go into that. So how long have you been diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder?
So it was a few years ago. It's probably about 4 years ago now. And I always knew there was something up, you know?
Okay.
Typically, with DID, someone when they get diagnosed, they've usually been through the mental health system for a number of years. I think it's like an average of like 7 years, and they typically get diagnosed with a bunch of things before.
It's misdiagnosed a lot, maybe as bipolar or schizophrenia.
Borderline. Often it's because there's a lot in common with borderline and personality disorder, like the sort of shifting personalities and things.
Oh, wow.
So always knew there was something going on, but it's like part of the disorder, or certainly like part of my disorder, is that one of my parts was always kind of trying to cover his tracks and kind of put me off the scent, you know. So I'd forget things. I was forgetting lots and lots of just things that I shouldn't forget, really. And then not really thinking about it, just going, oh, that's odd, and then just moving on my life.
It's like, oh, it's weird. What am I doing here? Oh, well.
So I finished high school. So I was 16, 17. And about a year after I finished high school, I went to a travel agent and I was booking a holiday. And I was sitting with this lass, and she was quite a young lass. She must have been a trainee or something. And I booked this whole holiday with her. And we got to the end of the whole thing. And she's like, you don't remember me, do you? And I was like, what do you mean? And this lass was, and I went to school with this lass.
Oh, wow.
Like, she was in my class every single day for like 4 or 5 years. She was in my registration class. So it was literally the first class of the day when you're doing roll call. She was in that class. And I had absolutely no memory of her. So like within a year of me leaving school, I really had very vague memories of school. And even my best friends from school, I would struggle to remember their names, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Did you at first kind of chalk that up to, I guess I just, so many things going on.
Yeah, I'm so scatty. I'm just such a scatty scary. I'd be like, oh, that's a bit weird, but I'd just move on. You know, I'd just be like, oh, that's a bit weird. I would just move on. And there was a number of instances like that just throughout my life where I would move from sort of one like period of my life, one chapter of my life, onto
kind of like those big transitions where you're like, you know, leaving school or going into a new career.
Sure. And for one reason or another, I guess I decided that I had to be a different person in this new chapter. And as I became a different person, the old person just sort of, I just kind of forgot what they'd been up to. You know, like I had a vague impression of the previous years, but I just kind of forgot like details, you know, and like details that you shouldn't forget, like who your best friend was that you hung out with every day for 4 years, you know?
Oh, wow. Yeah, because I was gonna say, I think all of us sort of, you know, maybe not as a conscious action, but when we shift to those new phases of life, we do grow and we change. You know, when you graduate high school or graduate college and you move into like having a career, you sort of let go of parts of you.
But new me, it's a new place, new me, and you try and become this other person that you feel as if you'd be more comfortable becoming or whatever. And that's a big part of dissociative identity disorder, is that it's like the bit we can all identify with is, you're not the same person all the time. You know, there's like work you, and there's friends you, and there's like family you, and, you know, and partner you. And although they're all you, you definitely act different in different situations with different people. Well, that's kind of the same kind of thing, you know. And in terms of the dissociation from your actions and the sort of not feeling as if that's you, that was you that did those things, everybody does that at some point. You know, everybody's had like some crazy night out and done some crazy stuff and went, I don't know why I did all that, you know, it just doesn't sound like me. And it's like, well, it was you, dickhead. It was you, but you're trying to distance yourself from your actions because it was like some other version of you, right?
Yeah, I mean, all I can think of is the amount of time specifically. I mean, there's more, but like all my college blackouts. But those were also probably helped by alcohol. My brain's like, we've had enough. We're just going to shut off this memory.
Yeah, you're not allowed those ones. Those memory blackouts, they don't count as part of the disorder. That's just booze, you know. It has to be fully sober blackouts, or else it doesn't count for much.
Yeah, were you ever, or are you a drinker?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So I mean, at different points in my life, I've been a heavy drinker. And that was one of the times where like one of my parts emerged as I was going through college and I started having like blackouts, but it's the kind of blackouts everybody gets when they're drinking.
Yeah.
But in reality, what was happening with some of my blackouts is they were happening hours before I even started drinking for that evening.
Oh, because wow.
To like be the extrovert for the evening. And he'd just be like, right, give me the wheel. And that would be, and he would be off and away. And I just, from like that point onwards for the rest of the night, I just have no memory of anything that happened. Now, obviously, alcohol is going to jump in there. But at the same time, I never had any problems with any kind of blackouts with alcohol prior to that. And I don't typically get any kind of blackout problems with alcohol. It does happen, you know. It was one of those things where it was happening and it's like several hours before I even started drinking alcohol for the evening, I'd black out.
It's like this other part of you kind of took over.
Yeah. But I just didn't think about it. I was just like, oh, that's a bit odd.
Because when it first starts happening, you know, like you don't know what's going on. It's just kind of like, oh, I guess I just sort of that. I mean, I think it's easy to, you know, try to rationalize things, you know, in our own brain, and we find different reasons for them. Like I could easily see someone having that incident going out. Maybe I guess my memory is just a little weird, or even instead of thinking it's a mental health thing, going like, is this like early dementia? Or because if you're just not remembering chunks, but you're like, I wasn't drinking.
Yeah. I mean, typically it's not, until I started really sort of diving into it in terms of the like knowing that I had it and really sort of working with a counselor to kind of work my way through it, I just wasn't really aware of it was the issue, because although I'd have some kind of memory of things, it'd be like a vague impression, And it wasn't enough of a blackout for me to be like, right, I don't remember that at all. That's very, very unusual. Because again, one of my parts, my oldest part, would cover the tracks, would just cover everybody's tracks to make sure that I wasn't really aware of what was happening, you know, because he decided really, really early on when he emerged, we shouldn't let other people know about this, including Franco, because that's a bit crazy.
Yeah. Okay, so obviously it's probably hard to pinpoint when those splits start happening, but what was the event or series of events that sort of kind of put you on the trail that, like, this is something you maybe need to resolve? Like, what made you kind of dive into trying to, you know, heal it?
There was a lot happening. So I got to sort of my mid-30s, and by that time, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but now looking back in sort of retrospect, I can kind of see when different parts emerged. By that time, there was just a lot of parts in me that had been dominant at different periods of my life. And by the time I was in my mid-30s, they were sort of at odds with each other. A lot of the parts just really didn't like some of the other parts, you know, really had a heavy dislike for some of the other parts. And my oldest part, which is the part that emerged to kind of deal with trauma, and had kind of taken trauma throughout my life at different instances, was just fucking miserable, you know, because he only ever came out when shit was happening and he had to kind of save me essentially. So he's like, fuck this. He just didn't really want to go on anymore. He was like, fuck, this life shit is just bullshit. Fuck this. But the thing is, he can't just take over and sort of, you know, make me top myself. He has to get the other parts on board. Mm-hmm. So for about a year and a half, he was sort of in the background, just kind of pushing parts around and manipulating my actions in such a way as to kind of push my life into a sort of inevitable conclusion where I want to hang myself, you know.
Oh,
and
man.
I remember at the time, whatever.
And the same, it's like, I've been there, but I have to be sympathetic about it because I know it sucks.
it is what it is. But like, I remember at the time when I was, my emotions were all over the place and my sort of behaviour was all over the place. And I used to even refer to different sort of, I kind of referred to different parts of myself as almost separate individuals. Like, I hate it when I'm that guy. I hate it when I'm doing that. I hate it when I'm that guy. But not in a super aware way. And
okay.
I also remember talking to a friend, because I was trying to like pull my life together, but just nothing. Every time I tried to do something, everything kind of fucked up and like exploded on me. And I remember to a friend, and I was like, it's like I'm playing a game against myself, but the part of myself I'm playing a game against is just much smarter and is planned way ahead. He's like 6 months down the line, and that's literally what was happening.
Oh, like, wow.
The part of me that wanted me to die had literally kind of set my life up to fail in the next half a year, and in a really dramatic and fucking abysmal way. So that at the time it failed, all the other parts would be like, right, fuck this, and would agree, let's just fucking grab a rope, you know?
Oh, wow. So it's like self-sabotage, but it's coming from like a full personality that in theory like is taking over at certain times.
Right. And the thing is, I was becoming peripherally aware of it because he was sort of overzealous, you know, when he was where previously he's wanting to cover his tracks and make sure I wasn't consciously as my core person aware of all these other parts and what they were doing. He was so desperate to die at that point that he was being a little bit too obvious. So I'd find myself saying things in conversations and then only realizing that I'd said it after I'd said it, and then almost listen to myself saying it and going, what the fuck did I just say?
Like, did that just come out of my mouth?
Yeah. Literally, like I would be talking to a friend and I'd say something to her and I'd hear myself saying the words, but I only realize that I'd say that after it happened, and then I'd be like, what? Wow. Did I just say that?
So it was almost in a way like observing yourself.
Right.
In action.
Yeah, well, I was dissociated from my actions, you know.
Yeah.
And And the terrible thing about it was that everything I was doing was, there were conscious manipulations almost to push people away from it or to create division or tension or just create some kind of problem. So when I was doing it, I was like, I'd like drop things into conversations that I knew would make people uneasy. And then as soon as I've done it, I'm like, why the fuck did I just say that? Well, I know why. I know now why I was saying that. I was saying it because at that time, friends were not going to be anything I was interested in because friends were going to be the things that would keep me from topping myself. So that part that was wanting to die was just like, fuck all of that. So like stage one of his plan to get me killed was, hey, let's move to another country where you don't know anyone. You know what I mean? That was like...
Yeah, well, and when you're in it, I imagine, is that something you realized like afterward that you're like, oh, that's really what was going on versus just having it where you're like, I'm just going to switch things up in the moment. You maybe just think like, it's time for a change.
No, it was like I had a desperate need in me to go to another country, to a city that no one knew me in. And just do things there. And the problem was that I can be quite a friendly fella and make friends quite easily. And that was a real issue because what happened was I got to this other place and then made some really good friends really quickly.
And that part of your that personality is like, come on.
It's like, fuck this. And just, it was like setting a social atomic bomb in amongst a few groups of people because every time I got close to some people and became quite close friends with them, that part of me was just like, right, fuck this. It would just fuck everything right up immediately. And like such overly dramatic ways and overly dramatic consistent ways in such a short period of time that it was almost like he was playing his hands in a too obvious a fashion because I was like, there's something going on here because I'm doing the same thing every time and it's in like in a space of like a year and in a way that I've never done this before. I've never had such dramatic friendships essentially before where I'm upsetting people on such a regular basis. Like what the fuck is going on here, you know?
And you felt kind of disconnected from all of those. It was just like all of a sudden things were kind of blowing up.
That's it. Yeah. And I was like, I felt like I couldn't stop it. I felt helpless, like I couldn't stop it. And everything was coming to a head. I even remember at one point I started planning my suicides because I was like I'm running out of energy. And that at some point in the next half a year, I'm just going to do this spontaneously. And it's going to be a fucking shit show, you know, like it's as much as obviously when you commit suicide, it's a fucking shit show anyway.
But you were like, this is going to have, you felt like almost like it was inevitable. So let me at least do it in a controlled setting.
I wrap my life up and I can, as neat a package as I can make it and then do it that way. So I had a kind of set plan of when I was going to do it. And I remember one of my friends at the time who was very, like just lovely and very, very close to me. She worked out what was going on. And I says, look, if I don't make a plan, I think I'm going to just run out of energy in like the next 6 months. And I'm just going to spontaneously one night just hang myself. And that's the worst possible way to kind of do this. As bad as it's going to be, that's the worst fucking possible way to do this. And I said that to this lass. And then literally 6 months later, that's exactly what happens. And it's like exactly what happens. I was just one random night, I had an epiphany. After spending time with some friends, it was nice chill time. I had an epiphany. They left, and then, like 15 minutes later, I was, jamming a belt in my doorframe, and around my neck, and that was exactly how it happened. You know, it was exactly how it happened.
Let me ask you in that moment because I think that a lot of people who have never experienced feeling suicidal. I sort of have this picture of it being, they assume that people are at their wit's end in a way that's like, my life sucks. I'm so sad. Yeah. It's so dark. And for me, when I experience being suicidal, and obviously it's much different than, you know, everyone's experience is unique. Mine was almost felt like the opposite, like a manic, I need to shut my brain off and I can't kind of feeling. What was going on in that moment? Was it like a, were you in a calm, like, oh, this just needs to end? Or was it kind of like a, I fucking don't know what to do. I can't do it anymore.
No, calm, like serene, almost. It was almost like, you know, like you kind of go through those stages of grief when you get terminal illness or something.
Mm-hmm.
Last stage is just acceptance, and you're just kind of calm about what's about to happen.
Yeah,
that's what I was at. I was just very, very, very calm, because like I was so certain about what I was about to do, because I'd thought about suicide plenty in my life, but yeah. Always get that kind of point where you're kind of standing there and you're about to kill yourself in whatever method you're going to do, and you're like, you're fucking crying your eyes out and there's snot dripping down your face and all that
yeah. type of
thing. Right, well, I think what I would say in that situation is you're probably not ready yet, because if you're that upset about what you're about to do, you probably haven't really accepted what you're about
to
do.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll probably find a way out. Like, that's always the kind of comforting thought I had in those moments where I'm, like, fucking standing on a box with a rope around my neck or some shit. If I'm crying, there's a tiny little voice in the back of my head going, you'll be all right. You know, you'll find a way out of this because you're too upset to want to do this. And the most worrying thing about the instance, like, what I actually sort of did to hang myself is I was calm, just really, really peaceful. And there was no delay in my actions. It was literally my friends left. I grabbed my belt, like real calm, no rush, no hurry. Grabbed my belt, jammed it in the door, stood on a box, looped the belt over my neck, and then kicked the box away. And it was pretty much as quick as that. There was no delay in my actions. And I was
Wow. So it was just almost like meditative, like, all right, just going to presently do this.
Just like, oh, well, guess it's time to die.
Well, then I obviously have to ask, what happened?
So the first thing that happened is as soon as the belt went tight around my neck, my survival instinct kicked in, obviously, because, I mean, because guess what? Your genes, they don't give a fuck about your depression. Your genes are just like, oh, that's great. Are you sad? Do you want to die? Do you want to have some fucking kids first? You fucking genetic transportation dickheads. Your only job, as far as your genes are concerned, is just survive and have kids. They don't give a fuck about your mental illness. So when you're in that situation where you're dying, the first thing you do as you're dying is you struggle to survive. You kick and scream and struggle to survive. And I was surprised at how much it hurt immediately, you know, because obviously you're not meant to hang by your neck, you know. If I looked a belt around my ankle and hung by my ankle, it would be fucking painful, you know, and I don't breathe through my ankle, you know, so it's not a great experience.
Oh yeah. Well, and they say that like with hanging, a lot, it's not, people think it's like running out of air, but a lot of hangings, it's like the neck breaking because your body weight.
Oh yeah, it's not even that, it's a blood choke, you know. If there's any like fight fans out there, they know that a blood choke, it doesn't take long to put you unconscious. It's only a few seconds, really, because it's just you just cut blood supply to the brain and you're just out, you know.
Fuck.
So I knew that I had probably at best 5 seconds. So I just kicked my legs and I managed to kick the door frame just beyond the door, and which managed to kind of give the belt a tug and tug the door open, and then the belt slipped free and I hit the ground. And yeah, it's one of those things where like it's super painful. So when you've done it once, like all that serenity that I had a few moments ago was gone. I was just like, yeah, that fucking sucks, man. I'm not doing that again. So I was like, yeah, probably just give therapy a go, actually, mate. You know what I mean?
So is that kind of like the event that you were like, I guess maybe I should try to figure out what the fuck is happening?
I mean, yeah, that was the biggest event, I guess. You know, that was the thing where I was just like, I mean, what I was shocked by was how calm I was about the whole the kind of seconds leading up to me hanging myself. Just
wow.
Super, you know, just super calm. And I was like, that was actually kind of chilling.
Oh yeah, for sure. That you were just so fine with it is like, whoa, yeah.
That's serious. That's not me fucking around or like, you know, like feeling like I want to die. That's me being very serious and deadly with myself. In a way that I hadn't experienced previously, you know? I just started realizing some things, and I think it was probably another year or so before I started really fully realizing there's some kind of dissociative thing going on here, because I was looking at photographs of myself from years gone by and felt very disconnected from the image of the person in the photograph. Like I knew rationally that's a photo of me. But when I looked at it, I was like, that isn't me. Like, that isn't me, you know? I sent you those photos, right, of me three different stages of my life.
Yes.
And there's like there's a clear difference.
Oh, they're you know? Very different. I have that too, though, where like I look at certain times in my life where it's like I'm all, and I guess I've always talked for my experience it, and that's I'm only saying this because I feel like there's probably, like you were saying at the beginning, people who relate to small parts of this. The disorder is just when it's larger and more extreme. I've always chalked up me looking back and being like, wow, I can't believe I used to be just as growth.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly that's a thing. Obviously, people grow and they develop and that's a thing that people do throughout their lives. But usually the person you are at, I don't know, 20 is still reasonably similar to the person you are at 30. You know, like you might have sort of learned how to deal with different situations in different ways and matured and got a bit more of a grip of yourself. But yeah. It's not to the point where your friends at 20 would describe you as a person and it would be completely dissimilar from their friends at 30 describing yourself, you know. Like that's growth, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
The difference with me was...
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the difference with me was, like, my friends that I grew up with when I was in my teenage years, if they described who they knew, it would have absolutely no similarity to the friends that I had when I was at college a few years later. Like, if they guys met each other and they're like, I've got a friend called Franco, and the other one's like, oh, I've got a friend called Franco, and then they started describing who Franco was.
Then they go, that's a different guy.
Yeah, oh, it must be some other guy. Yeah, that's not Franco. That's Franco's not like that. It's not another guy. Yeah.
That's
the difference.
Yeah, I'm only bringing it up because I'm trying to like see how to like show that difference. Because also, I think it's true for all of us, and I think it's a struggle with a lot of diagnoses for mental illness is that like the only brain you know you really have you that you're familiar with that you understand is your own. So I think for a lot of people, until they are diagnosed with something or they start treating something, they with mental illness especially, it's sometimes hard to know something is wrong, you know, because your brain can be making you feel like what you're doing is rational because that's what our ego does. But also, I think anyone to an extent has either, I wouldn't even say voices in their head. Some people do. They like they hear things like their thoughts come as like separate voices, or like I have conversations in my head with myself when I'm trying to think something out. So it's, I'm only saying this as like a sympathizing for how difficult it must be to really recognize for yourself that something's wrong. Like, did it take other people kind of presenting you with the idea that maybe it was a mental illness for you to go, oh, maybe there's more to this than just, this is just me. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean that was part of it certainly. Like I was living in Bali with this lass. And
sorry, that's just such a random. That feels like such a DID thing to be like. Yeah, I moved to Bali.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know it's one of those things. I've lived in a lot of countries, you know, and it's all because I wanted to get away
of
from
course,
the Scottish.
It's just.
Yeah, just yeah. So I was in Bali with this lass, and she'd actually known me for a few years, and I started sort of realizing bits and pieces about this, and I talked to her about it, and she was like, "Yeah, I think I've met like at least three different people." You know, like it just immediately made sense to her, and she'd even mentioned previously before I'd ever sort of talked about it. It was like when she first met me, she says like. It's like I've known three different people because the person I first met is not the same as the person that was at this time is not the same as the person at this time. And then some specific incidents has happened while I was there with her and I just have like complete blackouts.
Oh, wow.
About what, like at one point we had an argument and like I know that if I think about it, I can remember what the argument was about. But like right now, I can't remember what the argument was about. Just that it was serious, and wow. The only thing I remember is that there's a sort of there's just a blank area of my memory, and then all of a sudden I'm standing on the front porch of the house that we were living in, and it's raining, and I'm packed, and I'm leaving. Fuck. And I don't know why I'm leaving. I just know that there's a place that I've arranged to stay in, and that I have to go. And I have no idea why I'm leaving. I have no idea what's happened. I'm just walking out the door. And as I'm walking out the door, it's almost like I'm sort of coming to, and I'm sort of confused. What the fuck am I doing? But also with the knowledge of, but I know that I have to do this.
Yikes.
That was the big thing of just like, yeah, I need to speak to a counselor.
Yeah, that was a big moment for you, like that incident. Yeah. Where I've got to talk to somebody because this can't be normal or typical or healthy.
It just kept on happening, and since I've been talking to a counselor the last few years, and she's been pretty awesome, and we've kind of pulled a lot of my parts apart, as well as like looked at me exactly, well, why did this happen in the first instance? Like, what was the reason for this? And it's pretty obvious, like, why it happened in the first instance. Because when I was 3, my dad died. Oh, and wow. I just took it really badly, essentially, you know. My dad's Spanish, and he had a family in Spain when he was, I guess, his early 20s. And then he left that family to go to London and start a sort of new life for himself in London, get a job and things. And Spanish people are very family orientated, so I think it sort of tore him up a bit that he left his wife and his son in Spain, and he kind of fucked up, essentially. You know, he had a someone he didn't want to have a kid with. It's a familiar story, obviously, but it's in the 70s it wasn't that familiar, and certainly as a Spanish guy to do that would fuck you up a little bit. And I think when I came along, he was like, right, I'm going to do this right, I'm going to be a better father, essentially. So he had like a good job managing a really sort of top restaurant, which quit, and then decided to like start a business, a driving school instructor business, because it meant that he could work in the evenings and spend time with me during the day. Wow. And he just wanted to kind of dedicate, you know, really sort of being there as a father. So there's loads of photos of us like just hanging out. And my mum even says it, like, he was your best friend. Like, when you were like 3 years old, he was your best friend. He used to, we each other the same, you know. And then he died. And for years and years, I had a very distinct memory of my dad dying. He had a heart attack, which is, it kind of runs in the family. He'd got tested for it 6 months previously, because like literally like his dad, his brother, you know, his dad's dad, they'd all died of heart attacks, and he was like, fucking hell, this is a bit grim. I'll get tested. And he got tested for it 6 months previous, and he says, you're fine, but unfortunately,
fuck.
But as soon as your family history, it's one of those things where we're not going to see it coming. It's either going to happen, you're just going to die, or you're not. And that's unfortunately it did happen.
You just got to keep living until.
And so, and yeah, my doctor said the same, of just like, there's really nothing you can do about it, man. It's either it's going to hit you or it's not, you know, and that's just the way it is. And he was doing the gardening, and he just collapsed. And I have a memory of him that he's managed to kind of drag himself into the living room, and he's lying on his back, and I'm kneeling as sort of prone body, when my mum's in the background screaming on the phone for the ambulance to arrive. And that was the memory of I had of my dad dying. That's a false memory. That didn't happen.
That was
a creation of the part that emerged to deal with that whole situation.
So it was like created as like a trying to cope with the loss.
Part just sort of figured that I needed something.
Like some sort of clarity.
Right. But actually what happened was he was doing the gardening, but he just kind of started feeling like, you know, like he couldn't breathe and things. Came into the living room, sat down. My mum immediately realised what was happening, because like he'd been talking about, you know, the heart conditions, his family and things.
Yeah.
Took me next door and just said to the next door neighbours, can you watch Francis? Because my mum calls me Francis, because she doesn't even understand how shit a name that is, and everybody else should be Franco. So took me next door, says, can you watch Francis? And then came back, by the time she come back, the doctor was in my house at that time. And like by the time she come back, he like died within like the next couple of minutes. But I wasn't there, you know, I wasn't even there when he died.
So you were just kind of like, oh, I'm being sent to the neighbors, and then all of a sudden, your dad's gone.
Yeah, and when my mom gave me the news, my mom says that, you know, your daddy's dead, he's gone to heaven. And my reaction to that was just, okay.
Yeah, kids don't know how to cope, you know.
That was it. That was all that. And my mom was like, wow, he's been so good. You know, he's like not making a fuss. He's not kicking or screaming or any of that kind of shit. I didn't cry or any of that kind of, I just went, okay. And that wasn't me like not making a fuss. That was me going through extreme trauma.
Well, that's what happens with a lot of children. And I've, from what I hear, a lot of DID any type of dissociation and a lot of, you know, trauma-based mental health issues, it comes from some big event in childhood.
That's it, yeah.
Was your therapist the one who was able to kind of help you realize that?
It was during the course of just therapy in general that I started looking into my memories, all my memories. And I started asking mum about my dad's death. And she says, oh, it didn't happen like that. When I says, like, how I remember that. And she's like, you weren't even there. And then she told me, and she says, and I was like, what happened when you told me? And you were like, she says, you just said, okay. And then you were just fine.
Did you remember that?
No.
When she said it? I mean, you're 3 is so young for memories anyway.
Yeah. No, and I don't even remember. My memories don't actually kick in until I'm about 6 or 7, because the part that emerged to deal with that period of my life when my mum was so devastated and I just lost my dad, just essentially just took over, was like, I've got this.
And just like, and that shuts out the memories kind of, right?
Right.
Because I also have so few memories from my childhood, and from what I've, speaking to other people who have experienced childhood trauma, it seems to be a common theme.
Right, that's it. And because it actually kind of worked really well as a coping strategy, because
absolutely,
because as a kid, I was actually quite a nice, friendly, upbeat, happy kid, you know.
So relatable.
and like in a way that was almost, I was overcompensating essentially, you know. But it was like no one could ever tell that I just lost my dad, you know. Like there's no way, and I was just super friendly and everything was fine. And it was such a legit strategy that at each of my points in my life where something traumatic happened, or even I was just going through a hard time, like when I was at school and I was getting bullied loads and things, a part of me would emerge to deal with that situation. And specifically the part, if it was something bad that was happening to me sort of relentlessly, like bullying, it was the first part would emerge and just sort of take it on himself, just be like, right, I'll have this and I'll have this during the day while you're getting bullied at school. And then when you leave school, you can become yourself and go and have fun and like be a happy, friendly kid. But that was great for kind of getting me through those periods in life. But unfortunately, what it meant was that part that first emerged to deal with those situations and has dealt with those situations ever since was fucking miserable. Because the only life he's ever had is just complete shit, just trauma.
He's just there for trauma.
He's just there for the shit. He just turns up for the shit and just takes it, you know.
Is it like, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, although he is quite strong, like he's quite good at taking stuff, and he's quite good at thinking his way through situations. So like my parts don't have names. They just have like designations, you know.
So it's all Franco. You're never like, I'm Donald and you're wearing a wig. Like,
that's it. No, I'm just all Franco, because the first part decided right at the beginning, like, we're all going to use the same name because
we don't want to let anybody on.
Exactly, right. But they've got designations because they sort of, they differentiate between themselves. So he's the strategist. That's his designation, because his whole job is to turn up and just work out how to get us out of this mess. That's his long-term thoughts about how to get out of the mess we're currently in. That's his thing.
When that person, or excuse me, that personality shows up, have you found that that you're surprisingly calm during situations that are like stressful emergencies because of a personality being developed like that?
Really detached. Like that personality's, his main thing is he just doesn't have emotional reactions to things.
Yeah, but, which... Sorry, go ahead. You cut out.
As we know, as mature adults, like, you always have emotional reactions to things. You can just choose to express them or not. If you're not expressing them, you're just burying them. And if you're burying them, it's not any good for you. So that's his issue, essentially, is he doesn't
of
have
course. Emotional
things. He just buries it and lets it fester, you know?
That is so interesting, because I just wonder sometimes with when people are considered strong in certain situations, or, you know, like people who are calm in moments where other people are panicking, it's like, are you more put together, or are you just better at suppressing all of this?
Yeah, that's I think that's it. I mean, again, it is useful, because in certain situations you don't want to be the panicky person, you don't want to be emotional, you do want to keep control of yourself, you know?
Yeah, it is like having that person come in who is like, hey, like everything's okay, here's what we need to do to resolve this. Because I know I will be so anxious about the dumbest things. For instance, Skyping podcast interview, like calling my friends like you and whoever, or doing these interviews. It's like, oh God. But then in a crisis, I seem to be the one person who's like the most collected. And it's like, what is happening?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm the same. You know, I think I'm just very like level in a sort of panicky situation. I was involved in a terrorist attack a few years ago in London. I wasn't involved. I was just there. I wasn't involved.
Don't say that. If people see your photos, they're going to get very suspicious with that beard.
I was just around it. And obviously, in that kind of situation, there's just nothing but mass panic. Everybody's, you know, fucking
screaming and running.
And I just wasn't. I was just very like matter of fact of just like, right, I have to do this for this guy right now, because this guy's in trouble. That's what has to happen, you know.
Are you at liberty to talk about what that is? What was it, like on a train or what?
No, it was some silly Welsh twat decided to run over some Muslims in a van. And
I remember hearing about that. Fuck, I didn't know you were there.
Yeah, I was driving by. Probably like fucking half a minute after it happened, and I didn't understand what was going on.
Of course, you're just pulling up and you're like, there's panic.
Yeah. And I just pulled up and there's just like all these people and everybody's panicking, and it was just a bunch of bodies have been kind of mowed down. So it was pretty crazy. But again, it was one of those situations where I was just like, right, this is just what has to happen here. You know, and because I also understand the bystander effect of whenever there's more people around, there's less
chance. No one does anything.
Right, because everybody's looking at everybody else, go, will you fucking do something?
Oh, and everyone's thinking, well, someone must have called the police. Yeah, I'm literally reading The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell right now.
Right.
And it hits on that.
Right, sure. So, yeah, and there's been plenty of situations where it's a genuinely dangerous situation I'm in, but I'm always just pretty chill about it. You know, I'm pretty sort of practically minded of just like, right, here's the situation. How do I get out of this situation?
Like, you're able to analyze it and figure out what to do instead of, you know, being overwhelmed by emotions.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, how long, like, from the point that you're like, I'm going to go to therapy, first of all, are you still with your first therapist, or did you have to go through a few to find someone who you found helpful?
I've been through a few in my life, but I've stuck with the one that I've had for the last few years. She's certainly the best I've had.
How did you find out about her? Was she recommended, or did you just go blindly searching for a therapist?
I signed up to BetterHelp actually online because I've got this tendency to move around a lot, and I wanted a therapist that I could stick with regardless of my geographical location. So online therapy was just a better solution for me.
Nice.
I just kind of hit the jackpot, because actually she was kind of doing it because she's under normal circumstances, this therapist is like $240 an hour. Like, she's a really like high-end therapist, but she was doing BetterHelp, which is I think $180 a month or something for, you know, four sessions a month. She was that. Is almost like a bit of charity. She was just it's like her version of outreach. She's only going to get like $45 a session or whatever, you know.
Which is like, if someone is normally making And so I wonder about that so often with like therapists and stuff, because it's like, you know, they normally charge this, but they're charging this. And I think about myself as a freelancer and the times I've been like, well, this is my rate. And someone's like, well, this is our budget. And I'm like, I can do it for that.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. So,
but especially with helping people, it's like, I'm sure it's obviously like, I guess it's not, it's a completely different thing. But with comedy, it's like, yeah, well, like, nobody tell anybody that like I did comedy for free for the first how many years and I just love doing it. It's like when you really want to help people and you know you have a skill set that can help people in need. Like if you're a therapist because you care about people versus being like, I became a therapist because I heard there was money. I think that's like the difference.
Well, that's it. And she very much is that. Like she happens to get paid quite a lot because she's very good at it.
Because she does good. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Like, she doesn't require that money, and she requires what she requires from herself. That is that she does her job and helps people. That's what she requires, you know.
There's even been
a period in my life where I wasn't really making any money, and she was like, "Ah, forget about it." And she just didn't charge me. She sells every week for a few months, and just was just like, "Ah, don't worry about it. You know, get me some other point." She just didn't charge me, you know. Just genuinely. Like by far the best therapist I've ever had, not just in terms of her generosity, but because she knows what the fuck she's talking about, and she's experienced with what it is I'm talking about and things, and I've made real progress with her, you know?
That's amazing. How long into working with her, like, is she the one who diagnosed you? Or did you come to her already knowing, like, look, this is what somebody told me, how can we work on it?
I think I'd already mostly figured it out. And then when I started speaking to her, I was like, here's the things I've figured out and the instances of weirdness. And she's like, you're on the spectrum of DID. You're not high on the spectrum, but you're definitely on the spectrum of DID.
Okay. So it's a spectrum. There's people who are like, do full switches and like have these blackouts and probably can't even... that something's going on until it's really pointed out. Or
there's people who have like thousands of personalities. There's people who think they're goats. You know what I mean? Like there's a real.
Oh yeah, no. I have a friend who I interviewed at the beginning of this podcast, which is close to 100 episodes ago. Friendly. We're not like close. He lives in Canada. I met him at a festival, but he's got like 27 personalities, I think, and some of them are female.
Sure.
And they take over, and he's got like a wife and so many kids, and his wife was just like, would catch him dressed up as a woman and thought for a long time it was some sort of like closeted fetish thing, and like, it can go very deep.
That's it, and there's folks at that end, whereas with myself, it's more like at different points in my life, I felt as if I had to be a different type of person, and I just got a bit overzealous with it. But then once I left that part of my life behind, the person I became is still in me somewhere. Every so often he just pops up and sort of he either takes control or has a heavily sort of influential push on my actions at a given time, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's what it is for me. So it's not an extreme case, a DID.
Okay.
But it's also that you could consider a disorder because of the blackouts and because the personality switches can be so
extreme. Well, it's affecting your life. Yeah. So I mean that's have you guys identified how many parts there are?
There's seven currently. There's seven, but some of them very rarely sort of poke their head up, and there has been more previously.
Okay, I was going to ask, was there initially seven, or was there like new parts that emerged that you kind of didn't remember or had forgotten they were there?
Well, there's parts that like the way I refer to it is there's loads of people on the bus, but some folks are at the back of the bus and are not really paying attention, and there's some folks at the front of the bus and they are paying attention, but they're not that interested in driving. And then there's a few folks who
want to take the wheel.
They just want to grab the wheel. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, just jerk the wheel.
That's it.
So treating this, is it a thing where with your therapist, it's like, how can I learn to live with this just being the case of how my brain works, or is there some sort of treatment you're doing to try to like bring it all into one person, one personality?
More or less. So there's a couple of things that I do that are sort of regular things that help me. And one of them's called the conference table, where if I'm having some kind of issue, I sort of, you know, I do a kind of a bit of a meditative thing. And I imagine sitting at a conference table and all the parts who want to speak up are there. And then I just allow to speak without any judgment or any sort of argument or anything. Everybody can have their say. And we just kind of try and resolve things as best we can. Sometimes the conference table is just me and one other part that I'm trying to negotiate with. And it's about hearing the parts, what they want, and then just accepting that that's okay. And also try and make the parts see the other part's point of view in certain things. Like one of my parts is called the romantic, and he's a teenager. And his idea of love is like all the sitcoms and romantic comedies and shit like that. You know what I mean? It's like you're going to meet someone, that special person. You're going to have that special connection. They're going to see you for the little like quirky like individual that you are, and like everything's going to be great. And he's great as like a he's great as like a boyfriend, because he's just sweet all the time, and he's all about like love people and just being nice and just being in that zone, in that moment, feeling that emotion.
Yeah,
but he's shit at getting girls because he's too overzealous. He's too
corny.
and he's if he's attracted to someone, he's immediately just head over heels for that person.
That's what I was gonna say. I imagine if a personality like that were to sort of take the reins, that is grounds for getting into a relationship with someone who like you're more or less settling for something that maybe isn't what you fully want, but it's just like, is it like, you know, starry eyed? Are they're everything?
Yeah, kinda. He falls in love too quickly. Yeah, he's got this kind of fake idea of what romantic love is, you know. And
it's easy and beautiful.
Right. And that you can just express yourself and tell people that you love them, and they're gonna go, "Oh my god, you love me, that's amazing," rather than go, "That's totally inappropriate because we don't know each other that well." Like, you know what I mean? Like he's not good at getting with ladies. You know, he's good at being with ladies, but he's not good at getting with ladies.
Yeah.
And then there's this other part of me that's the charmer, and he's great at getting laid, but he's a fucking terrible boyfriend. He'd never want a boyfriend. You know what I mean? Because he's a fucking douchebag, fuckboy piece of shit. You know what I mean? He's all he ever does is he just says whatever he has to say in order to get laid, and then he does whatever he has to do in order to get laid. That's it. That's his whole thing. That's his whole fucking job. And he's good at it. He's real good at it, you know. But the romantic hates him because of how dishonest he is, and how he never has any real emotions for anyone. And he's only ever doing and saying the things he needs to do in order to sort of get from point A to point B. Whereas the charmer thinks the romantic's a fucking idiot, naive boy who is like, you know, should never be let around women, you know, because he's too much of a pathetic fool around them, you know. There's that conflict between those two parts, and I have to manage the conflict and kind of, you know, like, kind of, we kind of got to the understanding of just like, listen, we all need each other here, because like romantic, you need the charmer or else you're never going to get a girlfriend, and charmer, you need the romantic or else you're never going to keep on fucking the same person and actually have good sex.
That's so, what like, I was going to say is like in an ideal setting, or you're like, how can we merge the good parts of both of these people?
There has to be a handover. There has to be a handover at some point. You know, the charmer has to go, right, on you go, buds. That's your job.
Get in there, like a tag team wrestling match.
And the romantic at the beginning has to just shut the fuck up and stand back, because he know he's going to put his foot in his mouth and get sort of too involved in someone that in an inappropriate way too quickly, you know. So they have to just kind of work together.
Yeah. Let me ask you, when you're having these conferences, because like I've listened to, you know, I've read about and, you know, I've done various sort of like self-help therapy with like inner child work. So the idea of addressing the inner child. But you're saying you're sort of having these conferences. I'm trying to paint a picture. And maybe it's different from time to time. Are there times where you're speaking out loud and also answering to yourself in a personality out loud? Or is it all kind of going on in your head? How does it work?
Typically, it's just in my head, but it can be where I'm speaking out loud and then the personality is answering in my head.
Okay.
But typically, it's just sort of happening in my head. Because it is like a conscious thing. I do have to kind of sit still and kind of close my eyes and think about what I'm doing. You know, it's, I'm not just kind of muttering to myself, you know?
Yeah. In a way, I'm trying to think. But when you're doing this, does it feel like, is it like two different, or, you know, if it's everyone at the table, does it feel separate from yourself?
There's definitely a lack of identification with the voice that I'm interacting with. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I feel dissociated from it. You know, I feel separated from whatever part of me is wanting to say something or, you know, be heard. You know, that's yeah.
Interesting.
But at the same time, I'm still here. It's me. I'm not delusional. I'm still like, yeah, all of this is still me.
Still you. You know? I'm trying to think, what am I trying to ask? Okay, so how do you feel? Sorry, forgive me. I'm trying to find a way to, it's like a concept in my head that I don't have words for. Boy, okay. What a mushroomy sounding thing to say. Sure. I'm not on mushrooms, but that sentence sounded like it. There's sort of this idea, not idea, like, thoughts come into my head, and the more I've meditated and the more I've like worked on myself, I've gotten to this place of, and it's not constant. Sometimes I do feel very attached to my thoughts, but when I'm calm and able to really be in a place where I'm observing my thoughts, there's this sort of separation of me from the thought where in theory in theory, none of my thoughts are me, you know, sure. It's just a thought popping into my head. This might not be a question that can even be answered. How is that different, you think, like just random thoughts versus you knowing this thought is coming from this specific personality? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, that's the thing about it is that that's why it's when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, especially with someone like me who's not high in the spectrum, it's very familiar what I'm describing. You know, okay. Like, when you're having a conversation with yourself about why you should or should not eat the cheesecake, like, you're having that conversation with yourself. Now, you may not identify specific parts of yourself that have, like, names or...
Like, you're not labeling it as, like, this is the part of me that doesn't want to get fat, and this is the part of me that wants to cope with my feelings.
Right. You're just accepting that all those parts of you are the one part. And I am too, but there's just a clearer division between who it is I'm talking to.
It just feels very separated.
Right, that's it. And sometimes I'll do things or say things or even see photos of myself or video of myself or something and feel very, very detached from the thing I'm looking at or hearing or saying or whatever, to the point where I'm almost like having an out-of-body experience, you know, and it's more like someone's driving my body around and I'm just kind of observing what's happening and going, what am I doing next, you know? Like, I think I said this to you previously, it's like, you know, every so often you might find yourself walking into a room and going...
And going, why was I coming in here?
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'll do that, except I'll travel to another city. And as I'm like, pulling into the city and, like, finding a parking spot, I'll get out of my car and be like, why the fuck did I come here? Like, it's like it happened on such an unconscious level of just like, I took a shower, I got dressed, I went out of my car, I drove up the street, you know, I went on the highway, I drove to the LSA, I pulled in, I parked, and as I'm getting out of the car, I'm like, why the fuck did I, like, there was no real conscious thought process that went into everything. Wow. I was just in a kind of zone, in a kind of haze.
Almost like spacing out times 10.
Right. Yeah, it's just I space out for a few hours. But some, I mean, it's always interesting when it happens, and it's always like part of me wants something or is trying to tell me something or something like that. Like there's a few weeks ago I was doing some work, and I was doing some work on my van, and I was listening to an album, and one of the tracks came on, and I was sure I just heard it. I was like, I'm sure I just listened to this 10 minutes ago. But there's no way I've heard the whole album, because it's only been like 20 minutes or something, you know? So I got my phone and I looked at like what was going on. Like, if I put it on random play or something like that, what's happening? And I don't do that. I listen to albums sequentially. I'm anally retentive when it comes to things like that. So that's not what's happening.
Well, I think they're meant to be listened to that way, really.
Exactly. You know, and if you're not listening to it sequentially, you should probably burn in hell. But like, I had a look at my phone to find out what the fuck was going on, and like 2.5 hours had passed. I thought it was 20 minutes. What's happened is one of my parts was like, oh, I'd quite like to do this work, and just took over.
So you kind of just like, well, that's so interesting, because
yeah,
I've had that happen with work, where all of a sudden, I don't realize I've been working for 3 hours on something, and it's just like you've zoned in on it. But it's always sort of felt in a way like I'll go, oh fuck, I can't believe it's been that long. But then in a way, I'm, you know, unless I've, you know, missed some appointment or something, which hasn't happened from being zoned in, I'm kind of like, oh, I must have just been very into the work. It's become like meditative. But
right, and the only it's pretty much the exact same thing, you know, like. The only thing when this happened a few weeks ago is...
Okay, that concludes the first hour of my interview with Franco Marufo. That is all of the free portion of this show. If you would like to get the rest of the interview, which is a whole other hour long, head on over to patreon.com/ignoranceisblessed. For just $1 a month, you can get the full episode and other cool stuff. And you're supporting me. And my God, I need so much support. Please support me. That sounds so sad. Another way to support, if you like the podcast, no money at all, subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. Share it with your friends, because everyone's a little bit ignorant sometimes. Big, big thank you to John, Dustin, Greg, Jean, and Kathy, and Terry, exclusive members of the League of Extraordinary Idiots on Patreon. You guys keep these episodes flowing and keep me sane, and I'm having fun with our, we kicked off crappy hour, and that's another fun perk of the Patreon now, is weekly hangs, and you can be part of that. We've already discussed that. Ignorance is Blessed Patreon, check that out. Or, you know, just join the Facebook group to get into some banter with other listeners. Just look up Ignorance is hashtag Blessed Idiots on Facebook. Please keep in mind that no guest is or claims to be a representative for every person who has a similar identity. They're just one person sharing their own experience and ideas to help us get a peek at how things look from their situated position in the world. If you have additional questions for Franco, or you want to suggest a guest or a topic, best way to do that, put it in the Facebook group. Let me know. What kind of people do you want me to interview? Is there someone specific in mind? Send it my way. I am happy to do my best to fulfill your suggestions. So please keep giving those suggestions and keep asking questions. The more we ask, the more we learn, the more we know. And the more we know, the more we can look down on others who aren't as smart as we are. And isn't that the point? Thank you for listening. And thank you for being patient with my ignorance. See you soon, idiots.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.